Howard G. Buffett, son of Warren Buffett, is interested in bread, but not the kind of bread his father makes. When Warren and his wife, Susan, decided to leave the bulk of their fortune to philanthropy, each of their three children started a foundation. Howard G. was a farmer, and he dedicated his foundation to the elimination of hunger. And he's told the story of that mission in a book called 40 Chances, Finding Hope in a Hungry World, which chronicles his work as a philanthropist, farmer, and photographer. It's published by Simon & Schuster, and I'm very pleased that it brings three generations of Buffetts here today. Howard G., his son Howard W., and his father Warren, the CEO of Berkshire Hathaway. Welcome to our show.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Are you all here because you totally agree with everything that Howard G. has written in this book?
Well, I have a little more leverage over Howard W. than I do the guy on my left. So
I can tell you this. It's a totally honest book. I've watched Howie all these years, and you get the real thing in the book.
Well, I'm going to have to call them Howard G. and Howard W., right?
Yeah.
Or
yeah.
Does anybody call you W.?
Well, HWB sometimes.
No. You call me the Papa Bear.
Howard G., is there a downside to being the son of Warren Buffett? He wanted you to learn the business from the bottom. So what was your experience when you were in charge of ordering boxes for See's Candy Company?
You know, it's the only way to do it. Mm-hmm. And the truth is, if you want to understand it, and our philanthropy is the same way, and we write about it in 40 Chances, is you've got to show up. You got to start where everything happens, and that's how you're going to learn it.
Well, with other people working there, happy to see the boss's son working for
them. Not all of them. we had a few that didn't.
How did you find your way into farming? Are there any other farmers in the Buffett family tree?
Well, you'd have to go back a few generations, I think, but which wouldn't be unusual in this country. But I got into it by accident. It's a little too long a story to tell, but one of my first experiences was accidentally disking up my neighbor's corn. So I didn't think I was going to have much of a profession in agriculture. But they forgave me and helped me learn more. So
what do you raise now?
Mostly corn and soybeans and a little bit of wheat in our farms on Nebraska and Illinois.
Warren, did your parents raise you with any particular expectations of what you would do with your life?
Yeah, I think that they didn't have expectations in terms of wanting me to do something. But I got very interested in stocks when I was maybe 7 years old because my dad worked down at a firm, only four or five people in it, and I would go down on Saturdays and they had some books down there, and I would read these books while we waited to go to lunch, and I just got very interested.
As a parent, and be honest, did it concern you that all three of your children dropped out of college?
Not the least. Not in the least.
Is it fair to say that it took Howard G. a little while to find himself?
Yeah, absolutely. There were days, I can promise you.
much has been written about your decision to give the bulk of your wealth away rather than to leave it to your children.
Have given them some money, right. But 99% plus of what I've earned will go to philanthropy.
You've said that you don't look for 7-foot bars to jump over. You look around for 1-foot bars and then step over them. But isn't world hunger a 7-foot bar?
World hunger is. That's the difference between a business and philanthropy. In business, you look for the easy choices, and in philanthropy, you look for the tough problems.
Howard G., what are the 40 chances of your title?
The 40 chances, that title came from actually something out of my farming career where, a speaker once told us that a group of farmers, we were kind of looking at things the wrong way, that we looked at things that one season kind of blends into another season. And he really said, you only have about 40 crop seasons to grow the best crop you can and to do the best job you can. And it made me think about farming a little different. I immediately thought, well, I wasted at least 10 of those. I don't have a lot left. But then I took it to heart to life. I mean, you know, you have about 40 good, really productive primary years to accomplish your goals. And so that's where the title comes from.
So you apply it to more than farming.
Absolutely.
How does photography figure into your 40 chances?
Photography has driven a lot of what I've done. I felt in a lot of times, and I still feel that if I can bring photographs home and images home of things that I can't really describe well verbally, that it truly is worth 1,000 words. And it's been a huge driver in terms of some of the places I've wanted to get to and some of the things I wanted to see.
Many of them in Africa.
Many of them in Africa. I've been to 51 of 54 countries on the continent and photographed from all of them actually. Yeah, many photographs.
HWB, I'm calling you that. Did you grow up on your dad's farm?
Oh, I spent quite a lot of time on the farm with my dad. I had some varied tasks, I think, from from raking dirt to driving machinery around at a young age. But no, he kept me very busy, and it was a work ethic that is one that's worth instilling in any child.
And he also took you to Africa when you were just 12 years old?
Exactly, yeah.
Where did you go?
We went to South Africa. We went to Botswana as well on that trip, and that was really an eye-opening experience for me at that age. And we just started traveling many times a year from that year forward, spending 15 years going all over the world together.
And why was that eye-opening?
Well, it was my first real trip outside of the country.
This was South Africa before Nelson Mandela became the president?
It would have been around that time. I don't have my years.
It would have been about a year and a half or two after, about 2 years after, yeah.
Yeah, so I mean, seeing a whole new culture, but also understanding the interplay between human life and wildlife and seeing that firsthand. I mean, I have distinct memories of the first time, you know, seeing a giraffe or interacting with any kind of animal. It was really remarkable, but also then seeing all of the communities in the areas that we visited as well. And that's, I mean, we go into a lot of depth in that in 40 Chances, but from other parts of the world as well.
You say we because you've written several of the chapters in this book.
Yeah, I have.
How have many of the trips been as disturbing as they sound?
Oh, we have had...
Because some of these photos are really difficult to look at.
They are, but they drive home a reality for so many people around the world. And the thing is with a photo like the ones in 40 Chances, they don't lie. But at times, you don't want to accept the reality of what's in that picture. And Howard, you know, can speak way better to that than I can, but it's... No, there are some very, very difficult places to travel to and others with a lot of hope.
I was wondering, Howard G., about the photograph of the young Senegalese boy in shackles. Was it dangerous for you to take that picture?
Well, it turned out to be dangerous. I don't know how we talked the Marabu's son into letting us go in. And the guy is with us, you take one camera and no extra film. And we walked in, and there was it's one of the few times I walked in somewhere, and I was actually shocked to see what I saw. I saw kids chained to trees, chained to each other, and I had 36. This was before digital. I had 36 frames, and I was trying to use them carefully, but I had to act like I was photographing the teachers and the other things. And as we left that place, I wasn't sure we were going to get out alive. We had people banging on the car trying to stop us.
Why? Because they were angry that you had
photographed? Oh, they're very angry. They got very angry. I mean, a camera does that sometimes.
Well, it's one thing to know that people are hungry. It's another thing to see photographs of people who are shackled or starving babies who probably will not have survived long past the picture was taken.
I can name three pictures that I know that the girls in them, young girls died within 3 to 4 days after I photographed them. And it kind of leaves an empty spot in you because you just feel helpless. You can't do anything. And it's very frustrating.
You went to Angola in 2006. What's the cause of that country's food insecurity?
Well, it's still an infant in terms of coming out of conflict. And so it had a number of years of conflict that sets back agriculture in many ways. But they don't have the leadership in some of the agricultural areas, and they don't have the infrastructure to deal with it.
And you have a photograph of a woman with one leg in Angola with what looks like an axe coming out of her head.
Yeah, I still remember that. Driving down the road, I'm trying to figure out what in the world is going on. And we stopped, and she was very polite, and we just asked her how she managed. And that's the resiliency of people. I mean, it's amazing. You tell me I'm going to give you an axe, and you're going to farm like she farms, and by the way, you're going to lose a leg. I would have given up.
You tried to come up with a plan to help one village. What would that have entailed?
Well, it was the best lesson I've ever had in two things. One is I learned that it was going to take $4.5 million for one village, and I knew it wasn't possible. And I thought about tens of hundreds of thousands of villages across the continent and realized it wasn't a realistic way to do this. And the other was that you can't always move things fast enough to save people.
But NGOs try to deal with these things. You say that their approach, which is one project at a time, is the wrong approach?
I will say this, that approach is never going to solve the problems at the scale that the problems are. And, you know, if you're trying to approach problems, you know, that are huge problems, you've got to deal with scale. Project by project, it isn't going to work.
Warren, is there value to someone coming from the outside to evaluate an organization and suggest ways to improve what it's doing?
Huge, because
isn't there resentment?
Well, there can be that, and then of course the trick is to get an honest evaluation. But the market does not. There's not a market test in philanthropy like there is in business. So people can pour money into a given organization, and it can be ineffective. And as long as they'll put the money in, it'll keep going. It's not that way in business.
Well, I've seen even in business organizations that get stuck with just doing business the same way because that's the way it's always been done.
But the market, when the consumer tells them that it really isn't done that way anymore, you know, just try selling typewriters now or something of the sort.
Yeah, somebody's either out of a job or the business is broke.
Well, correct me if I'm wrong, but many of the stories here seem to say that the way we've been approaching various problems hasn't worked. Does having a significant amount of foundation money help you persuade organizations to change their focus?
Well, I'll tell you what it does for us. The most important thing it does for us, it gives us what I call risk capital. And because my dad agrees with this, it makes it very easy to do it because ultimately it was his funding. We can go in and take risk that nobody else will take, and we can fail because we don't have to ask anybody for money.
When Dr. Norman Borlaug started the so-called Green Revolution, people declared him a hero. But you say the legacy of the Green Revolution is a little more complicated.
Well, it is more complicated. Dr. Borlaug is a hero. He helped us understand things that today are going to change things in the future. So it doesn't change his legacy. I just say that today, you know, we've gone through that process, and we need to adapt to what the problems are today. And the bigger problems today are how we deal with soil and natural resources.
Is there a difference between soil and dirt?
Most people treat soil like dirt. And, soil as like a – if you're holding in your hand, soil, you have like a – how many
– Yeah, you have more living organisms in a tablespoon of soil than you have people on the planet.
Yeah. It's a living ecosystem, and people don't treat it like that.
You also face the problem of people telling somebody, well, if you plow this way, it'll be a lot more effective than the other way. And they'll say to you, well, this is the way my father plowed, this is the way my grandfather plowed, and my great-grandfather. Who are you to tell me what to do?
Well, that's what 40 Chances is about. It's about mindset. And that we only have, a limited time, so we have to be urgent. And we only have a limited time to make those changes. And I can show factually why certain practices are better than other practices. So I just have to have the chance to do it.
One of the traditional practices is slash and burn farming.
Yeah, it's the worst kind of farming there is, but you have to understand why it happens. It doesn't happen by choice. It happens because people don't have other choices.
Warren, you have said that risk is ignorance. Doesn't that apply to philanthropy as well?
Well, there is risk, and there should be risk in philanthropy. If you just do the easy things, as far as I'm concerned, there's nothing wrong with that. But we should be tackling problems that really baffled people in the past, and there's going to be real risk in that, and we're going to fail sometimes. If we don't fail ever, we're tackling the wrong things.
Of course, there's all sorts of reasons for hunger. There are wars. Poverty that is hard to overcome. How can we mitigate the impact of hunger under those circumstances?
Well, hunger creates conflict, and conflict perpetuates hunger. So it's a difficult one. But, for instance, we're working in Eastern Congo today, and one of the types of risk we're taking is that we're willing to invest in some ideas that nobody has done in the past.
Now, Eastern Congo has been beset by war for a long time. As I understand it, more people have died there than died in all of World War II.
That's exactly right. And I'll tell you, it is where more women are raped on a regular basis than anywhere else in the world. And you talk to those families, you talk to the mothers, and, you would not want your children in that environment. And so we believe we ought to work to change it.
Do you think that you got part of your international perspective because of your mother?
She let
you go to Czechoslovakia?
Well, my mom wasn't going to let me go to Czechoslovakia at 14 in the middle of when the Soviet had occupied it. But my dad actually intervened, one of the more important interventions in my life, to be honest with you. And said, let him go. It'll be a good experience. And it was an unbelievable experience.
And then years later, in the mid-90s, you were actually detained in Bosnia for taking photographs?
Yeah, they took my camera. They broke one of my cameras. I got it back broken, but and they took my film. And you know, in that environment, the one thing that kept going through my mind is I wish every U.S. citizen could experience the fact that I have absolutely zero due process. I have no rights. There's no phone call. There's no advocate. There's no lawyer. There's nothing. And it really makes you appreciate what you have in this country. America is an amazing country.
Howard W., in your opinion, is the most important goal to maximize food production?
No, I think the most important goal is to effectively maximize our effectiveness in solving our problems. And that will vary on what part of the world that we're in or what population we're trying to help out. But it's not always just about supply. There can be many structural challenges along the way that mean that you have an overabundance of supply, but it spoils or it never makes it to the market. So there's a lot of factors to take into consideration.
Well, you talk about hybrids being good, and you're not so supportive of organic farming in this book.
Well, I will say this. I think it takes every kind of technique done well to feed people. And I will say that in Africa, most farmers are going to be organic farmers, not because they want to be organic farmers, but because that's how they're going to farm. And I'm 100% for that. I think what we have to do is give them the right kind of tools and the right kind of knowledge and the right kind of options so that they can be effective at being organic farmers.
You do talk about how sometimes we, because of cultural differences, we misread what's going on in Malawi. Didn't Westerners misunderstand both the status of wasps as a food and the importance of the mouse hunter in that culture?
Yeah, that, I think it was termites. I've been offered a lot of things to eat, and I've become pretty good at finding excuses why I can't eat something.
You'd be surprised what his religion forbids.
but they're high in protein.
They might be high in protein, but they're not. I'd rather have M&Ms or something. I don't know.
Warren, when you look at the work that Howard G. has done, both in farming and his foundation, do you see any logical application of ideas about value investing?
Well, it can't be measured the same way, but these are the ultimate values that he's working on. The idea that millions and millions of children or people should be hungry in a world where we have the ability to produce what we have. Those are great human values. So I admire what he's working on.
Howard W., you wrote a rather disturbing chapter about your experience in Thailand after the tsunami. What were you doing there?
Well, I was there as a learning experience. My father wanted me to have as much exposure to different approaches in philanthropy as I could as I was growing up, and one of them was to take a trip to Thailand and to see what had happened in the response to the tsunami there. And I was there about a year and a half after the tsunami, and we did see a number of things that were upsetting in the way that the local community wasn't involved at all in the decision-making process around how to rebuild their homes and provide them with what they needed. You know, there were examples of containers of broken toys and heavy winter clothing being shipped over. I mean, this is a tropical location. And there was just almost no context to some of the solutions people were trying to bring about.
Well, it's my sense from reading this book that you don't have much respect for the way NGOs have been doing things. Is it possible
to
change?
Yeah, it's very possible. I would put it differently. I would say that we have a process that doesn't allow NGOs to do some of the smartest and best things that they could do. There are great NGOs out there. We work with them. I mean,
well, Doctors Without Borders, for example.
Yeah, we don't work as much with them, but they do some amazing work. And I like them because they take a lot of risk. But, you know, it's a process. If I have to come, I don't have to come home and show success, and I don't have to come home and ask for more money. And when that's the driving factor in how you have to behave, you're going to behave very differently.
Warren, I have to ask you a question. I'm sure you've been asked more than once, but the U.S. just managed to avoid default this month. Didn't you express confidence that default wasn't going to happen?
Yeah, I thought it was not going to happen because I didn't think we possibly get that 535 people that stupid in Washington.
Well, aren't there Tea Party Republicans who've expressed regret that the deal was made? Some of the Republicans who voted for the deal are already being threatened with primary challenges.
That's one of the problems we have, is that congressmen are more worried about primaries than the general election in many cases, and understandably so, the way the districts have been gerrymandered.
Are you pleased when people call you the Oracle of Omaha?
In Omaha, they don't call me that.
I have other labels for that.
Well, what about you, Howard? Are you called the Oracle of Malawi?
No, not at all.
The three of you have been such great guests. I'm sorry that we've run out of time. But my thanks to Howard G. Buffett and Howard W. Buffett, who have written a book called 40 Chances, Finding Hope in a Hungry World. The foreword was by Warren E. Buffett, and it is published by Simon & Schuster. Thank you, all three of you, for being on our show.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.